Hi, welcome to The Good Robot Uses. This is episode one. I'm Andy Balaam, and this is...
Andy Cockerill.
And just the title, nothing else, but the title of the film we're going to be reviewing today is...
Gone Girl.
And I'm now going to give you a plot synopsis and I think a short review of the film based on absolutely no knowledge whatsoever of anything except the title. I mean, I may have heard some stuff about it. I don't know. You do hear things and probably end up with an impression. But as far as I know, the only thing I've got is the title. So here's my plot summary. A girl it's basically a misery memoir, right? So there's a girl, she's beaten up by her father, and you watch her grow up. It's pretty miserable. She has a couple of horrific, abusive relationships with boys. Things are coming to a head. Maybe she's run away, hence the title, maybe. And she's nearly dead. You can see she's about to sort of... The way she's behaving is going to end up in her dying. Then she meets a girl who kind of rescues her and everything looks like it's going to be okay. And then it all ends badly and that's the end. That's my plot summary.
Okay. That sounds like a Japanese horror movie.
my favourite kind of movie.
In fact, that bears little to no relation to the film Gone Girl, or indeed the novel on which it is based.
I'm glad to hear that.
So, yes, Gone Girl is based on a... I think maybe we should say at the top of the podcast here that this is going to be very spoilerific.
Okay, yeah.
So we're going into detail. If you haven't seen Gone Girl, stop listening now, go and watch it, and then come back and listen again.
Unless your review is going to say that it's rubbish, in which case they shouldn't bother.
That's a fair point. Yeah.
So you're in a quandary now, listener. You'll have to go and watch it and then find out later that you were supposed to think it was rubbish.
Yes, exactly. So Gone Girl is based on a novel. I'm just doing that great thing when a man looks something up on the internet. I did have all of this ready. It was based on a 2012 novel by Gillian Flynn, or Gillian, I think she likes to be known as Gillian Flynn, called Gone Girl.
And the Gillian Flynn.
Flynn, yes.
On what basis do you think she likes to be known as Gillian, given that it's normal to be called Gillian?
I think I heard somebody else say on the radio or on another podcast.
You read it on the internet.
I think I read it on the internet, yes, that's right. So I may be wrong, but...
it sounds extremely unlikely.
It's possible. The movie is directed by David Fincher, who's a director that you and I both admire. For sometimes different reasons, but he's also made Fight Club.
Right, I like Fight Club.
Yes, I liked it in part. I didn't like it as much as some people like it. And Social Network, which I liked a great deal.
Which I didn't like at all and found annoying and boring.
Okay, no, I really enjoyed... I think I enjoyed the misanthropic tone.
I think the thing that listeners need to understand at this point is that that you're here to tell us what we should think. So that set me straight on the Social Network.
Maybe you should watch it again. It's got a very fine soundtrack by Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross.
I like Trent Reznor.
Yeah. Yes, David Fincher directed this, who is a somewhat divisive filmmaker. You know, he started out directing feature films with Alien 3, which was essentially a release date that was earmarked before a film was actually made.
Renowned for being rubbish, isn't it? But actually, it's fine. It's quite good, almost.
Well, I think that the original theatrical cut is pretty good, and the what's known as the work print, which has been released since then, is much better.
Right.
But David Fincher wants nothing to do with it. He was treated so badly by the studio making it that he wants nothing to do with that film now.
So he wasn't involved with this work print or anything?
No.
Okay.
No, not at all. He was he basically washed his hands of the film, which is I think mainly he's angry with the administration at the time at Fox,
right?
Because he has since made quite a few films for Fox, and this is one of them. So so yes, David Fincher, he has a pretty what's the word I'm looking for? He's quite an acerbic director. You know, he doesn't shy away from showing us a dark black human soul at times. Mm-hmm. Things like Fight Club.
Yeah, or for example, this plot about this girl who gets beaten up by her dad.
No, but she does. So Gone Girl. The synopsis is that the film stars Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike as Nick Dunn and Amy Dunn, and they're married. They've got a lovely house in the country, but things are not quite as they appear. You know, he's without work, and she's the sole sort of breadwinner.
Do I know her from anywhere? I don't know the name, I don't think.
Rosamund Pike, she was in one of the Bond movies, one of the bad Bond movies. She was in Pride and Prejudice, which you may not have seen.
I won't have seen that.
No, you won't have seen that. It's a waste of time me even saying that. I'm just looking through it to see if she's been in anything. She was in The World's End. Have you seen The World's End?
No, I think people will understand gradually over time that I haven't really seen any films.
Any film.
Which is what makes me so suitable to host this podcast.
Okay, so... So yes, Rosamund Pike plays. She's a British actress, and has so many great British actors are going over the pond and doing fantastic American accents in American productions like Hugh Laurie.
Yeah.
Who I couldn't quite believe was Hugh Laurie in House, but anyway,
he is brilliant in House. Is she as good as him?
Yes.
That's her accent. I don't care whether she can act.
Yes, she is. She's really good in this. In fact, she was nominated for various awards. So they live in the countryside, but things are not really all that good between them. And one day, Nick comes home to find her missing.
Mm-hmm. And she's gone.
She's gone. There's a mess in the kitchen. There's a bit of blood splatter in the kitchen, although not very much. Some things are out of place. And he phones the police. And the police come in and are initially... He's not a suspect, really. But as the film goes on, the police delve deeper into it and get, you know, the forensics start crawling over the house, and then they decide that actually he is a suspect, and they arrest him.
Now, do we know that he didn't do it, or are we left guessing as well?
We are left guessing until about halfway through the movie when it pulls a psycho or a it changes in tone.
Oh, so he dresses as his mother.
No, he doesn't dress his mother. I mean, in terms of... Psycho,
that was me showing off that I've seen a film.
That's very good. You've also seen Audition as well, which is also a film that changes tone halfway through.
I have seen Audition. That's difficult to forget.
It is hard to forget. That Audition's, I think, one of the only films that's made me feel physically sick whilst watching it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it.
halfway through, we suddenly... The narrative changes from his story to find out that she's still alive.
And that she
planned it all. So she carefully orchestrated it looking like she's been kidnapped. In fact, she's still alive, and she's watching his trial by television closely to see what's going on.
Okay, so now we know for sure that he didn't do it because we know that she faked it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So we know for sure halfway through that he didn't do it.
Okay, that's really ruined it for me now.
Well, I did say this was spoilerific.
Yeah. Well, if I was going to watch it, that would have really spoiled it for me. Actually, it sounds really intriguing. I really like films that really flip something in the middle and then carry on. It's just because it's unusual and it's...
And it does continue to flip that as well. So she's been keeping a diary, and she's making a note of when she's going to be doing certain things based on what's going on in the real world with him. And there comes a point when he engages the services of a hotshot lawyer who's, you know, does cases like these where the man seems to be completely guilty and has no hope of getting away with it. he goes on TV and gets interviewed by a kind of female Jeremy Kyle type person.
Mm-hmm.
And he does really well.
Okay, so TV. Things are turning around.
He turns it around, and right. At this point, she realizes that her plan may have backfired, because really what she wanted to do was to humiliate him.
I was going to say, what is her plan? But okay, her plan is just to... She just hates him.
She hates him and she wants to humiliate him. But at the point that she realizes that he's turning it around, and then she realizes that even though he's turned it around, there's still no evidence to suggest that he didn't do it, he might be facing the death penalty.
Right.
In the state that they live in. So it's at this point that she decides to go back.
Right. So how far in are we now?
We're about just over, I'd say we're probably about three quarters of the way in.
Right.
So she decides to go back. But before she goes back, she goes to see her ex-lover, played by Neil Patrick Harris, who was Doogie Howser, M.D. Do you remember that
really?
Show?
Really? I know Howser, him. MD? I know him from such films as the
Starship
one with the
Troopers.
Aliens. Yeah, it's Starship Troopers.
Yes.
Where, in which he played Doogie Howser, M.D., I believe.
Yeah, and in this he plays a creepy version of Doogie Howser, M.D.
Very much the same character from Starship Troopers.
Pretty much, yeah, although he doesn't wear a kind of SS coat in this, which is a shame.
Yeah, that is a shame.
That is a shame. So she goes to see him. As safe haven, basically, because she's been mugged by her neighbours at a kind of motel place. She's got no money and basically run out of resources. She can't use any of her cards or anything like that, because if she does, people will know she's still alive.
Okay, so she's been kind of holed up all this time, has she?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, trying to be anonymous, but she's been flashing the cash a bit too much at the motel.
Right.
And getting a bit friendly with the locals, and the locals have realised that she's a, you know, they can steal from her, basically, because she's on the run.
Right.
And in a kind of parallel to... have you seen Lars von Trier's Dogville?
No. Is that the one that has no sets?
Yes.
Yeah. I've heard about it. I haven't seen it.
So the premise of that is that Nicole Kidman plays a woman that we know nothing about, who arrives in this town called Dogville that has no sets, but is populated by some very fine actors like Stellan Skarsgård and Paul Bettany,
fine actors,
people like that, fine actors. And once the locals in this town realise that Nicole Kidman is on the run and nobody else knows she's there, they start to realise that they can do whatever they want to her.
It goes a bit Lord of the Flies.
Yeah. And this is what happens in Gone Girl. So the people that Amy Dunn has been hanging around with at the motel realise that she's probably on the run,
mm-hmm.
and that they can pretty much do what they want, so they rip her off,
right.
and tell her to be more careful next time, which is quite kind of them, considering that they're criminals and that kind of thing. Or maybe they're not criminals, maybe they're just kind of chancers who are a bit, you know, short of cash. So she ends up at her former lover's house, which is sort of like this high-tech house full of cameras and surveillance, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing.
Is he happy to see her?
He is, but in a sort of parallel to Dogville, he realises that right. nobody else knows she's there.
Right, okay.
He's the only person that knows she's alive.
So this is backfiring badly.
Very badly. Very, very badly indeed. So she now realises that she's more stuck than she was before.
Right.
And meanwhile, back in Nick's life, it's starting to look like the investigating. Police person.
Mm-hmm. Where is it? Set in America. Yeah, yeah, of course. Because you said death penalty. Yeah.
It's starting to think that there's more to this than meets the eye, because. I'm sort of referencing other films here that people might have seen, but there's a scene in a Steven Spielberg movie called Minority Report.
Yeah, I've seen that as well.
Have you seen that?
Going right.
So where Colin Farrell, presented with what is essentially an evidence scene, says, do you know what this is? This is what's called an orgy of evidence. And the thing with this orgy of evidence is it doesn't exist in the real world.
Right.
Nothing
right.
like this exists in the real world. So the police investigator in Gone Girl starts to suspect that something's up because it's all too convenient.
Yeah.
You know, what starts out as cast iron evidence that he did it is starting to look like...
That's very Columbo.
It's very like turning around and saying, there's just one more thing.
Yeah, it is. There's so many, yeah. You can imagine in real life, police are like, oh, there's a lot of evidence for this. Yes. Oh, well, that means it can't have happened. I can't imagine that happens too often.
No. So she starts to get suspicious, but the case has now been turned over to the FBI.
Right.
So she no longer has any jurisdiction over it.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like Nick is going to get sent down. Meanwhile, Amy is still at her ex-lover's place, and she knows that she's in trouble.
Yeah.
Because he locks the doors so she can't get out.
Right.
But she engineers an escape.
Are you rooting for her, or are you just hoping she gets what she deserves?
Well, it's interesting, you see, because neither Nick or Amy are... particularly nice characters.
Mm-hmm.
And what's clever about the film is that it shows two or three scenes of him getting physical with her
mm-hmm.
when he gets frustrated. But because the way that the film plays out in its non-linear fashion, you're never really sure whether that actually happened or whether she is manufacturing it.
Right.
So it's quite clever in that regard. It misdirects you a lot.
Yeah.
But regardless of that, neither of them are particularly nice characters.
Yeah.
So she realizes she's in real trouble, and she engineers an escape by, because his whole house is covered in CCTV, she makes it look like, after he's left for the day, she makes it look like he's assaulted her by spilling wine down her nightdress and then screaming inside the place.
Right.
And making it look like she's been assaulted.
This is rather convoluted.
It is, yes. And then when he gets back, she kills him.
Okay.
And escapes.
So is that on camera as well?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. And then the next scene that we see is her driving up to Nick's house with a massive amount of media and camera crews outside. Driving up to the house and getting out of the car.
Right.
Everybody just kind of standing there with their mouths open like, oh, she's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And so she comes back and she tells Nick that she's pregnant. And he is basically left with a choice. He can leave her, which would make him look dreadful in the eyes of the media. Now, this woman who's been kidnapped, he could leave her.
Yeah.
Or he can stay with her, knowing full well that she could put a knife in his back at any time because she's already done it to somebody else.
So he knows that she's manufactured.
Yeah.
The whole thing.
He knows everything.
Uh-huh.
But he's basically stuck.
Uh-huh.
And that for me is one of the most terrifying things about the film.
Is that the ending?
That's the ending.
I see.
Yeah. That's the ending.
Oh, good. I don't need to see it now. It sounds quite good.
It is very, very good. Yeah. It keeps... Up until the point when you know she's alive, it keeps you guessing about everyone's motives. Because not only does she implicate him, she also manufactures a whole history of herself in the town, none of which is real.
Mm-hmm.
So... When the police investigator asks Nick earlier in the film, you know, does she have any friends? You know, is there anyone we can talk to? He says no, that she didn't really interact with anybody in the town, which is actually true.
Mm-hmm.
But what she's been doing is making friends with people and telling them, you know, that Nick's been beating me and all this kind of thing, but don't tell anybody about it and all this kind of stuff. So these people then come to the police and say, mm-hmm. I'm Amy Dunn's friend.
Yeah.
So then get suspicious.
Yeah, okay. So now I see how the net closes around him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he is perplexed by this because he knows nothing about these friends. He knows nothing about her social life. You know, she's manufactured everything. It is pretty terrifying. You know, in terms of There's more scary stuff in here than a lot of horror movies in terms of it being credible.
Yeah.
So
tell me about the style, because if I think about Fight Club, that has a very particular style that's presumably intended to communicate something about kind of...
Can you describe what you mean by the style?
In Fight Club, the style of Fight Club, if you ask me, especially I think particularly of the scene where everything in his bedroom is from IKEA, and the little IKEA things come up. But also throughout the film, it's like deliberately highly polished and like a product. Everything is like, including and especially Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
Is this product that we're being sold?
Yeah,
and that, you know, and supposedly the subtext of the film is that we should reject these products, or actually the film itself is another product that we're buying.
Yes, it's extremely subversive like that, isn't it? Fight Club. Okay, so yes, Gone Girl is very slick. So so you know, David Fincher has been shooting digitally since he shot Zodiac, which I think was about like 2007, something like that. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't seen
that. That's about the Zodiac killer in San Francisco.
Ah, okay.
In the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
That's Jake Gyllenhaal and Robert Downey Jr.
Mm-hmm. And was that back when digital was a quality?
I mean, that's back when people like George Lucas and Brian Singer were shooting digitally for the first time, basically. Mm-hmm. And Finch is one of the early adopters of digital.
Right.
But Gone Girl is also shot digitally, but it's obviously much newer technology. It looks fantastic. You know, it's really slick, smooth-looking film. You know, there's no rough edges on this thing. It's
So hang on, let me just stop you there, because I thought you had a policy of only liking films with wobbly cameras.
Yeah, no, there isn't much wobbly camera in this.
So I don't understand how you like it.
Okay, so I think I make exceptions for films of high quality that don't feature any wobbly camera. To be fair, I think that it's only really Paul Greengrass who floats my wobbly camera.
Who wobbles your camera in the way you like.
I think so.
Okay, okay. Yeah.
So yes, it's very slickly done. It's been, you can see that it's been meticulously worked out, and the editing and the editing is there to misdirect you at every turn. Incidentally, the writer, Gillian or Gillian, never know, Flynn, also wrote the screenplay.
And this was a book. It was a book first. Yeah, you said that.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, well, I don't know. I shouldn't go on about Fight Club, but I have seen Fight Club. In Fight Club, I read the book after watching the film, and it felt to me like the book was always just a film, just a screenplay. You know, the book has nothing to it that's not in the film.
Right.
Have you read the book?
I haven't read the book, but I have heard, I've heard an interview with Gillian, or Gillian Flynn, in which she talks about the changes that she made for the screenplay.
Right.
Things that she had to get rid of.
Yeah.
In order to make it work, which was interesting. I mean, I can't really remember what she was talking about, but you know, specifically. But she did talk about changes that she had to make to it.
So it's probably more of a substantive book than that.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you look at good books made good movies, they usually have to jettison a great deal of it
in order to make
it work.
Yeah.
I suppose one exception there would be The Shawshank Redemption or Stand By Me, because they're based on novellas.
Also, if you just make the film long enough, base it on a novella, make the film really long.
Yeah, that's
right. Or make one short book about a small furry animal into three extra long feature films.
Small furry animal?
Small furry person.
What are you talking about?
I'm talking about The Hobbit.
Oh, The Hobbit. Oh, yeah, okay. That's completely justified. So, yes, it looks slick.
Not calling it a furry animal, though. That's not justified.
It's got a great cast as well, Gone Girl. So, right. You've got Ben Affleck. Now, the interesting thing about Ben Affleck is that he has a very wholesome, public image.
Yeah. But you can imagine him winning over the public in the way you're describing.
He's
definitely that kind of person.
Yeah, but in this, he subverts his wholesome public image because he has, you know, anger management issues. Right. He may or may not get physical with Amy during the film.
What do you mean by get physical?
He hits her a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Or does not. He? You know, we're not really sure whether he does or not. Or at least I wasn't completely sure. So he's subverting his wholesome persona, and that really works well to make you doubt him, basically. Yeah. You know, did he actually do this?
Yeah.
And then Rosamund Pike, who's really only played, you know, pretty straightforward damsels in distress type roles or sort of costume drama type roles, is an absolute revelation in this. You know, she's completely different from anything she's ever done.
Yeah.
And when I heard her interviewed on Kermode, you know, and Simon Mayo was interviewing her, which that's another a proper movie review show, in which he interviewed her and said, you know, this is quite a difficult role. You know, Amy Dunn is not a nice person.
Mm-hmm.
So David Fincher must have seen something in you that he thought you could pull this off. And she said, yeah, I think he did, but I'm not really sure what it is.
I'm not going to tell you what it is.
No, exactly, yeah.
I think that trick of picking someone that you trust, partly because they have a trustworthy face and partly because you've seen them in other things, and then making them bad, is a brilliant trick when it comes off. I'm obviously thinking of Payback, because as you know, Payback is my favourite.
Mel Gibson.
If you judge films by the number of times I've seen them, Payback is far and away my favourite film, apart with the possible exception of Wayne's World.
Yeah, you and me love Wayne's World to death, don't we?
Yeah, although I haven't seen it for a long time. I don't know whether I still do.
Sure.
There was a time when there was an audio cassette of the entire movie in my car that I used to listen to over and over again.
Well, you listened to the whole thing on an audio cassette?
Yeah, I just manually taped it onto a tape. And then...
That's incredibly obsessive. That's like the time that I recorded half of Blade Runner onto an audio cassette.
Oh, yeah.
And you used to listen to that. But the thing with Blade Runner is there isn't much dialogue in
it. No, that must have been pretty dull.
It's pretty boring.
Yeah, well, it was the only way I could be absolutely sure I knew the script off by heart, you see.
Yes. Yes, quite. That's important. Either that or you could just watch the film a lot.
Yeah.
Which is what
anyway,
I did.
Other than Wayne's World, I watch Payback a lot. And one of the beautiful things about Payback is Mel Gibson is such a convincing, nasty guy.
Yeah.
And it subverts your feelings about him from films like, what was his famous films that he was in?
Lethal Weapon.
Lethal Weapon. He's such a nice guy in the Lethal Weapon films.
Although he is also quite, you know, he's got a past in Lethal Weapon, but he is a good guy. He's definitely a good guy.
He's a good guy struggling under difficult circumstances, isn't he?
Yes. And, yeah, he has tended to play conflicted but good men in his films, whereas Payback is the flip side of that coin. This guy's definitely a bad guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Payback is great. So yes, I mean, you've got Ben Affleck and Rosamund Pike both subverting.
Both doing that, yeah.
Yeah. Now, supporting cast is also great. There's an actor called Tyler Perry, who I had to look him up on the internet to see what he'd done before, and he's a very influential African-American actor, who I've seen before in a couple of things, but he plays the hotshot lawyer.
Right.
And he's really good because, you know, he's Mr. Smooth, you know, Mr. Public Persona, and he's the guy who says to Ben Affleck that you shouldn't go on this show and try and talk it around because you will lose. You know, this woman this host is going to eat you alive on live television.
But he goes for it anyway.
He goes for it anyway and he wins.
Hmm.
And then at the point when Amy returns, the hotshot lawyer's like, well, okay, you don't need me anymore. And then just gets in his car and drives away.
Okay.
So he's good. He's funny. And then there's an actress called Kim Dickens who's been in a lot of stuff, actually. She was in Paul Verhoeven's Hollow Man. Have you seen Hollow Man?
Yeah.
Kevin Bacon?
Yeah, I didn't like that at all.
No, it's dreadful, isn't it?
Oh, good. I'm glad I think correctly about that one.
Yeah, it's really, really dreadful. I mean, I don't know if it's as bad as Showgirls, which I haven't seen.
Either. I haven't seen Showgirls.
No, it's one that I need to watch at some point, but I'm not sure I can bring myself to do it. It's not as bad as that, by all accounts, but Hollow Man was pretty bad. But anyway, Kim Dickens is in that. She's also been in... there's an HBO series called Tremé, which is about post-Hurricane Katrina New Orleans.
Right.
Which is very good. She plays a chef in that. So she plays the police investigator in Gone Girl. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she's a really solid character actor. You know, she brings a lot of gravitas to that role. Mm.
So I'm getting, one of the things I'm getting from you is I'm getting two solid female roles that are proper characters, not just addenda.
Yeah,
or
definitely.
What's the right word? Not just attachments for males, but proper characters.
That is true, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the thing is that she is a really good investigator, and she has a really cynical male partner who, that they're kind of switching the roles there, because in this case where it's, you know, a disappeared woman and the man is implicated, you could imagine in another filmmaker's hands them saying, no, let's swap it over, let's have the man investigating and the woman being cynical and saying we should just arrest him right now. But they actually swap the roles over. She is quite circumspect and gives him the benefit of the doubt for as long as she can. Whereas her male counterpart is basically, as soon as he walks into the house, he's like, well, can't we just arrest him now? Because he's clearly guilty. So that's a very clever juxtaposition of roles there, which is very enjoyable.
Okay, so it's something that I find myself doing with films recently, or maybe not recently, maybe when I watched more films before I just dried up, is I'll walk out of something that I enjoyed, and I'll say, what was the point of it? And I won't be able to answer the question. And maybe it's just the wrong question, but I found myself asking it a lot. So,
okay,
what was the point of this?
What is the point of Gone Girl?
Yes.
Okay, so I think the point of Gone Girl is that David Fincher and the screenwriter, let's call her Gillian Flynn from now on, because that joke's getting a bit old.
Why don't we shorten it to Jill or Gill?
Okay, well, it's called a Gill, because that's a character from Finding Nemo, and that film's got a soft spot in my heart, so we'll call it Gill.
Okay.
Or Jill. Gill or Jill. Gill or Jill. I think the Fincher, with the exception of The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, which I despised as a film.
Haven't seen it.
No, it's dreadful. Okay. I think with the exception of that, he likes to show us the dark heart of humanity for 2 hours. And then at the end of the film, just say, it's okay, you can walk out of the cinema and everything will be fine.
Okay.
But he once said in an interview, he said, I don't like films that affect me. I like films that scar me inside.
And that is very interesting.
He was talking about Jaws, the movie Jaws.
Yeah.
And he said that's a film that scarred him inside. And when he said that in an interview, I completely related to that, because my mother took me to see Jaws when it was released now 40 years ago.
Really?
So, yep. So I was the same age as my son when I went to see Jaws.
Yeah.
And it traumatised me.
It's pretty scary.
Until last year, when I finally went in the water, in the sea, and swam for the first time.
You're joking.
Jaws. No.
40 years later?
40 years on. It had that much of an effect.
Okay, and are you saying this is a good thing?
I'm saying it's a terrible thing. Yeah. However, that's an extreme example, but you know, David Fincher wants to show us stuff that gets under our skin.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think that's a really good answer to my question, and a better answer than you'd get for most films, I think.
Excellent.
I think that a lot of art, modern art, is often trying to kind of show you the depravity or the horribleness of something, especially people. One of my questions was going to be, it sounds like the answer is no, but one of my questions is, is the point of it the same as the point of a good horror film? Because you're talking about the horror of it.
Yes. I mean, there are horrific elements to this. So, probably really only one when she cuts Doogie Howser's throat from ear to ear.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty horrible. Because she actually willingly wants the blood all over her.
Mm-hmm.
Because she
mm-hmm.
wants that as evidence. So anyway, yes, so her story is... I don't think I said this, actually. But I'm coming back to the plot. Her story is that her ex-lover kidnapped her and has been yeah. keeping her captive all this time.
Yeah, yeah, no, I got that, yeah.
Yeah. Which, if police look closely at his CCTV, they will see is complete bunkum.
Yeah.
Because she hasn't been there that long. But that notwithstanding, mm-hmm. it's a good cover story.
So that, in terms of the horror, not just like gore, but you know, in terms of it filling you with horror and showing you the dark side of humanity, is it like a horror yes. film in that sense?
Yes, it is. So, I mean, if you compare it to other horror films that don't have any gore or blood, so like a good ghost story mm-hmm. gets under your skin, mm-hmm. something like mm-hmm. Poltergeist,
mm-hmm.
Something like that, that really gets under your skin and rattles you. This is a film that does that.
I'm thinking of Let the Right One In, maybe.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good example. Or Pan's Labyrinth. Although Pan's Labyrinth does have physical moments of physical horror in it.
I couldn't be bothered with Pan's Labyrinth. I think maybe I should watch it again.
That's a shame. I think it is really good. It's one yeah. of my favourite films.
I find if I have yeah. a nice bottle of wine to drink, I like almost any film.
I think you could probably apply that to most things in life.
Yeah.
Although maybe not anything by Take That.
Yeah.
So yes, to sort of round the answer to that question off, it has horrific elements in it. You know, the horror of being implicated in a murder.
Yeah.
the horror of being stuck in a loveless relationship, which is what they seem to be in. Is, yeah. You know, Fincher doesn't. A lot of directors would sort of go for the kind of the exploitation angle and try and amp up the melodrama.
Mm.
But he doesn't do that. You know, he keeps it all so that it all seems completely credible.
Mm.
And that's in the way that Stephen King has succeeded in writing about horror that lives next door,
mm.
this does the same thing, basically.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Is there also an element of wish fulfillment that if you're stuck in a awful relationship that's not very dramatic, you know, it's just that your husband hasn't got a job and is annoying.
Mm.
This kind of idea that maybe you could ruin his life because you hate him so much, even though you haven't necessarily got that good yeah. a reason for it.
She is definitely enjoying it. And that she enjoys it up to the point when she suddenly doesn't
yeah.
enjoy it anymore. and that basically comes before she gets robbed. So she's mm-hmm. already made, she's already, although we don't know what she's going to do, she is trying to make a decision about what to do next.
So there's an element of morality tale.
Yes.
Like with any good horror film, there's the people who do wrong get punished for it. But then the ending, of course, doesn't...
But that's it. They don't, yeah. you see. It's that she gets away with it. He is now trapped. And
that serves him right for being so boring.
It does. He is extremely dull. Yeah. But it's the way in which she springs the trap around him that is very clever. But in the end, it's too clever. It's too much of a... All the things are too much of a coincidence for the police.
Mm.
But by the time the police realise that there's too many coincidences, it's too late. But of course she comes back, so he's off the hook. But, you know, Fincher knows how to... You know, he's been doing this long enough that he knows now how to push our buttons
mm.
and manipulate us. And it's a long film as well. It's 2 hours and 29 minutes long. And it grips you from start to finish.
In a way, it's a thriller, isn't it? You know, the classic thriller always has... Often ends up with the bad guy winning.
Mm.
And it always has this kind of evil character who you only discover quite how evil they are as time goes on, kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it, in that respect, it has a lot in common with The Usual Suspects.
Right.
In that there's flashbacks. It's non-chronological.
Right. When you say that, what do you mean? What is it just one long segment and then another segment that overlaps with that, or is it more complicated?
It's a bit more complicated. So it jumps around in time, and it has voiceovers from Amy. So Amy talks about when we see that she's still alive, there's some backstory into why she's done what she's done.
Right.
And it kind of fills in the blanks. And each time the police find a clue, there's a little backstory from Amy describing how she stitched him up in that particular way, which is very clever. So the way in which she makes it look like there's been a struggle in the kitchen is she cuts herself and, you know, gets blood all over the floor, spreads it around, and sort of sprays some on the cooker hood, and then cleans it all up, but leaves one little bit of blood splatter behind.
Nice.
In the way that if you were cleaning up, you might miss it.
Yeah.
But of course, when they go over it with their UV, they find massive amounts of evidence all over the floor.
Yeah.
And they find sort of her hand marks on the floor where it looks like she's been trying to crawl away from somebody, that kind of thing.
Mm, mm.
So it all looks credible. But the police investigator, the female police investigator, is not convinced completely. But there isn't enough evidence to say that he didn't do it.
Mm.
You know, there's overwhelming evidence to say that he did, but there's not enough to say that actually he's innocent.
Yeah.
And that's what happens in it. So, So anyway, my parallel with the usual suspects is that it keeps you gripped. You know, it keeps you wondering who is who. That parallel disappears when you realise she's still alive. You know, it's then no longer like the usual suspects.
That's good, because I think the usual suspects is massively overrated.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
I think I've only seen it once, and I did enjoy it.
I think, I don't know, I think a lot of people enjoyed it because they really liked the idea that they'd been fooled. And, it had successfully fooled them. And I just felt cheated because I felt like it was impossible for me to have known otherwise.
Yeah.
Because I saw it, you know, it wasn't just him telling a story. I saw it all happen. So why then am I, how was I supposed to know it wasn't happening when I saw it happening?
Yeah, that's a fair comment, I think.
But I don't know. I think probably a lot of people enjoyed it because they enjoyed what happened in the film.
I don't think it has the rewatch value of something like The Sixth Sense.
Right.
Which you can watch again and again and again and look for the little tells of what's happening.
The bleakness of The Sixth Sense.
Yeah. It's
when you're watching
it again
and you know it's lovely and bleak. My only problem with Sixth Sense is when the crucial thing happens right near the beginning, my wife turned to me in the cinema and said, "Oh, I know what happens."
Oh no!
And then I knew as well. And so I only got the rewatch version of Sixth Sense because I knew on my first watching. So I never got the original experience.
I didn't figure it out, and I stayed away from spoilers before I watched it.
Yeah.
Which is hard to do. I mean, it was easier to do back then. It's really hard to do now because they're everywhere.
Especially if you listen to a podcast like this.
Well, yes, but if you listen to a podcast like this before you watch a film when you've been warned at the beginning not to, then you deserve it, quite frankly.
I must say, in terms of listening to a podcast like this, as I've been doing without having seen the film, it's left me definitely wanting to see the film. It sounds really good.
It is really good. I think to sum up, because I think we've got to stop soon.
That'll probably do it.
I think to sum up, I would say that this is David Fincher's, you know, finest film to date.
Sounds like a mature piece
of work. It is. It's, you know, if you were to take this and Fight Club and put them side by side and people didn't know who'd made them, they might be able to figure it out by the stylistic touches. But actually, it looks like a completely different director. You know, it looks like a guy who's really at peace with who he is. And
he knows how to tell a cracking story kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
Yeah, I have issues with Fight Club. I think I'm probably in the minority. Fight Club is a very highly regarded film by lots and lots of people. But I have issues with it. And I don't really have any issues with Gone Girl. I think it's a fine piece of work.
We should have another podcast to talk about Fight Club, because
yes,
he won't find that I'm a complete advocate for it. I think I enjoyed it loads, and but in the end, I feel like I was sold a product, which is exactly what it's trying to tell me I shouldn't do.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, I think I need to rewatch it, and we should do that.
Maybe we should do one.
I think we should.
I was going to say, before we finish, we should just I should ask you whether you've got any ideas of what we're going to do in future episodes.
Well, can I talk about the radio show that I present?
Yes, you can.
I can. Okay, so I present on a radio station called Glastonbury FM, which broadcasts all year round, not just when the festival is on, which it is on now, actually. I present a radio show on Glastonbury FM, which is an hour-long music and movie reviews show, which is nothing like this podcast. I don't go into any of the detail. I don't spoil anything.
It's very good.
Oh, is it? Oh, yeah. Thank you. This is much better. Mainly because I get to go into fantastic detail about stuff and talk about other films, and which is I'm reliably informed by my other half that I do far too much, which is true.
This is the joy of new media, you see. We've got no time limit. If people can be bothered to listen to us, we can keep talking.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So, yes, I present that show, and this is, unrelated to that show, but is related to it in terms of the fact that it's about movies.
And you're on it.
And I'm on it.
And you're on this.
Yes, I am. But you're hosting this. I'm just a contributor to this.
That's true. You're my expert.
That is true. I'm now an expert.
Well, by virtue of being on a radio show, you're an expert.
I'm an expert, yeah. That's right. So I'm not sure what we're going to do next. I think we need to talk about that. And maybe for the next time we do this, we should have an idea of what we want to do next, so we can talk about it at the end.
Yeah, but we can definitely we've mentioned a few classic films. If we wanted to do any films that aren't just recently out, we could talk about some of them.
We can do whatever we want. I mean, what about we could look at something that you probably haven't seen that I watched recently, which was the 1967 version of Thomas Hardy's Far From the Madding Crowd.
There's no way in the world I'm ever going to watch that.
I didn't think so. I didn't think so. So I think next time we'll talk about that.
That sounds brilliant.
But we'll talk about it in relation to the 2015 version, which came out a few weeks ago, which is a very fine film indeed. But they're both very fine films, but for different reasons. So I think a bit of detail, spoilerific, talk about those two would be good.
That sounds excellent. Okay, well, thanks for listening, everyone. If you have feedback or improvements you'd like us to make, or films you'd like us to talk about, please add comments on the various sites where we post the podcast, and we'll be back with Far From the Madding Crowd or something else next time. Any final thoughts, Andy?
This has been I would just like to say that at the beginning this was toe-curlingly difficult, because I've never done anything like this before. I present the radio show on my own, and I write all the stuff up, and I compile the playlist, and this is totally different. This is like somebody asking me questions about stuff and having to come up with an answer. I think as we've got along, it's gotten better and easier.
It's been good fun.
Yes, it has been good fun. Yeah.
See you next time.
Yeah, thank you.